I'm going to introduce two people you already know. Nayaswamis Jyotishan Devi, as you all know, or mostly know, are the worldwide directors of Ananda now. Swamiji named Jyotish his successor, and for many years before his passing, put the two of them in charge of Ananda in every practical way, and also, of course, invested in them great spiritual responsibility. It's largely because of the careful training that Swamiji gave to them and their enormous dedication and receptivity to the training he gave that has allowed Ananda to continue as smoothly, as graciously, and as expansively, and with so much inspiration in the 2 years since Swami passed, and in the years before when he was beginning to withdraw. They have visited our community, of course, many times over the years with Swamiji, and usually at least once or twice a year on their own to help keep us all aligned in the same way, attuned to the same vision, and receptive to the vision and the understanding of what Ananda is supposed to be. Their qualifications are self-evident, 45 years and more of devoted discipleship, but time is not really the factor. It's the perfect expression of what Swami calls the ideal Ananda disciple. I don't want to embarrass them too much, but it's an important point. Swami said that it's having someone in charge of Ananda is not really so much about making decisions or anything like that, but to keep in front of us on a global scale what the ideal Ananda devotee looks like. And we have in Jyotishan Devi, have always had, just the perfect picture of discipleship, humility, kindness, wisdom, great sense of humor, taking yourself lightly. Everything that Swami exemplified has been passed on. So there really is no one else on the planet more qualified to speak to us about our topic tonight, which is Master's work in the world and Ananda's place in it, something of great importance to all of us, and we are very honored to have this opportunity to attune ourselves more deeply to that vision. So thank you very much for coming. God bless you.
Not sure that it's deserved, but it's very kind. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Great Masters, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Guru, Paramahansa Yoganandaji, Saints of all religions, we humbly bow to you all. O great masters, beloved Guru, help us understand and appreciate the depth and breadth of what you have brought us. And help make us channels to bring thy love and joy to everyone we meet. Om. Peace. Amen. Well, we're going to talk about Master and his mission to the world and then Ananda's part in that. And in order to do this, we have to talk about Master, and I don't want to do that in a kind of half-hearted way and hold back, but please understand that I'm not trying to be sectarian. I'm trying to be a true and loving disciple of this great path and what we've received, but Master is God himself, and so to talk about him as if he's separate from other great expressions of God is to actually do a disservice to him rather than a service. So when I talk about how great Master was, understand behind that it's how great God is. And yet, if we don't have some concrete expression of that, you know, if someone tells you, and you don't know the concept well, somebody explains something about love in an intellectual way, we can't grasp it. But if you see someone or feel someone who loves you, or you feel love in your heart, that then becomes concrete. So the principles are hard to grasp sometimes until we see them expressed in a way that we can get our minds and our senses around. But beyond that, you know, God is everything and everyone. And so I don't want to be sectarian, but I don't want to hold back either. Okay, Master is great. Master is greater than you can imagine. Master is greater than you can imagine that you can imagine. He has come back again and again into this world. This whole line of masters that we have come back again and again in this world in order to help mankind and planetary consciousness adjust to the change of vibration of the yugas. The four yugas start with the lowest of Kali Yuga, and it's a very dark time, stuck on form and separation. If you take water and you take all the energy or a lot of energy out of that water, you end up with ice, and that ice can be chopped up and cut up into cubes, and those cubes can be separated, and you can see them, you can get your hands on them, you can measure them. They stay in place. They're stuck there. They're not going to move on you. And that's Kali Yuga. People don't move. Ideas don't move. Religion doesn't move. Creativity is barely moving. And so Kali Yuga has a particular kind of expression to it. And all of the forms that we have during Kali Yuga have to fit that vibrational level. Otherwise, they don't work. And so in Kali Yuga, you need a particular kind of religion. And that religion is one of set prayers and rituals and formulas. And this is what you do and this is what you don't do. And it's very clear cut. And for that time, that's the only thing that can work, as is said about the Norman battle axe, crude but effective. And so religion during that time is not very philosophically sophisticated. But now we have come with a new age, a change of ages. And the age that we're in now is coming out of Kali Yuga, and we're still experiencing the tail end of Kali Yuga thinking. That's why we have the melting ice cubes of different religions clashing up against each other. And the fear in certain fundamentalist groups that know that their grasp on existence is melting as they see it around them. The world is changing, and the world does not fit their concept of the world, and so they're trying to essentially stop progress and wipe out change and wipe out people who think differently from them. And that's ice cubes bashing against ice cubes. And in the age that we're in, see, Dwapara Yuga brings energy. And so that energy is actually energizing some of the old ways of thinking. And so as Devi once described it, old Kali Yuga ideas are still in the world, and they're energized by the expanding energy of Dwapara Yuga, and she once described that as dinosaurs on steroids. And so we're in a very challenging time, because if you look just on the surface of things, it seems almost as if the world is deteriorating. But in fact, it's not. And there are many, many ways, and I don't want to go into all of that. That's not a sociological lecture. But what I do want to say is that Master and this line of gurus have once again incarnated at the time that they were needed in order to bring about a change of energy. They've done it before. In dwindling Dwapara Yuga, when Dwapara Yuga was about to end, and we were going to go into the cycle of Kali Yuga, they incarnated at that time. And those are the characters in the Bhagavad Gita. It's Arjuna and Krishna. These same souls came at that time in order to help make that transition from a lighter age into a darker age. They were almost certainly around at the time of Christ. They were around at the time of Christ. Master said that the three wise men were Babaji, Lahiri Mahashai, and Sri Yukteswar. He didn't talk about where he was at that time. It may have been politically incorrect to say too much about that. But they were there at that time. They were there at the time when the ideas were beginning to be seeded so that Kali Yuga could move into a more energetic phase, and governments and central, the bringing together of people and the fundamental aspect of the rule of law as opposed to lawlessness at the time of William the Conqueror. And Sri Yukteswar and Master were incarnated at that time, along with Swamiji. And so this group has come again and again, and especially when the world consciousness is changing and we desperately need some guides in how to move forward. So Master, particularly in this age, came this group of avatars. One could say in a certain sense that there were multiple purposes that they came. Just to back up a little bit, so Babaji, according to what Master said and what we know from the autobiography, and not just this tradition, many other traditions in India also, Babaji has been around for centuries and centuries. And so he's essentially the guide of the planet, the planetary guide. And so at the right time for this age, he called forth this group of avatars that have been associated with him over and over again. He says, okay, boys, we got some work to do. Come on down, because we need to begin to infuse into the world what is going to be necessary to live not only successful lives, but spiritually uplifted lives, happy lives. And so the techniques, the mindset, the attitudes that will be successful in our age are different from what would be successful 1,000 years ago. And he said, come and begin to show how we should do that. One of the major changes is, and it's captured in the interaction between Babaji and Lahiri Mahashaya. Probably almost everybody here has read the autobiography. But in that chapter, Lahiri is miraculously called to go into the Himalayas and meets Babaji at Babaji's cave. Last year, Devi and I went to Babaji's cave, and we're leading a couple more pilgrimages there this coming October. It's a very, very spiritually potent, powerful place. But there, Babaji called Lahiri to him, and basically Lahiri was reawakened. I don't think he was ever asleep, but for the sake of us. He was reawakened at that time, remembered his past life with Babaji, and was basically in samadhi for many, many days. And then when he came out of that state, he was, you know, at that time he had the first Kriya initiation, the first modern Kriya initiation that we know of in any public way. He had that. And when he came out of it, he, of course, same thing that we wanted to do, wanted to stay there and kind of be with Babaji, stay there, be in samadhi most of the time. But Babaji said, no, there was a reason that you weren't called here until you were a married person with a wife and children and a job and moderate worldly responsibilities. Well, there's a backstory to that. It's not like, oh gosh, he just kind of happened to wander in one day and that was what he was tasked to do. He actually, before knowing that this was going to be his incarnation, he had the concept, the thought, that in the past, in Kali Yuga, the way that a person who was serious spiritually expressed that was they withdrew from society. And so you had some people, sadhus, who were withdrawn from society, and they were doing their sadhana, and they were doing hours and hours, if they were really sincere, hours and hours of it, and that was continuing. But they were supported by the householders. And yet they looked down their noses at the householders for not being spiritual. And Lahiri said, that doesn't work. That isn't especially going to work in this age. We need a really efficient technique that householders who have worldly responsibilities can use as their spiritual technique that will help them accomplish in a relatively small amount of time what could otherwise be accomplished by hours and hours of sadhana. In other words, we need the jet airplane path instead of the bullock cart path. We need Kriya Yoga. So he incarnated in order to be the vehicle to bring Kriya Yoga into the world. That was his primary job. And along with that came the responsibility to show that this, in this modern age, in Dwapara Yuga, that Kriya Yoga and the deepest, sincerest desire of devotees can be practiced by people who have worldly responsibilities. And he didn't just say it, he lived it. You know, I mean, if you're an avatar, you don't necessarily have to choose an incarnation where you're an accountant for the British government if you're in India and barely have enough money to keep your family together because it doesn't pay very much. You know, I mean, so on a logical level, he didn't have to do that. But on a spiritual level, he had to model for us. Yes, you can have a family. Yes, you can have children. Yes, you can have a job. Yes, you can struggle to keep things together. And you can do all of that, and yet you can be completely devoted spiritually, and you can be of the highest possible consciousness. And he had rajas and kings and people secretly. He had a very kind of private mission or expression of it. He had a little bedroom, basically, as big as most of our bedrooms, and that was his whole temple, church. And people would come there, and he would tell them not to talk to each other very much, to keep it quiet, don't advertise. He was just planting the seeds. But that doesn't mean that, therefore, that's the right thing. It was the right thing for him, his expression of it. And then Sri Yukteswar comes along and he has a particular expression. During the time of William, Sri Yukteswar was Anselm. And Is that right? Lanfranc. Lanfranc. And Lanfranc was a teacher, the same as in this lifetime, Sri Yukteswar had, remember, he always had an ashram and a lot of children there, and they would come and study with him, and that's what Master did. Well, in the lifetime as Lanfranc, he basically trained all the bishops and the cardinals and the popes of medieval Europe during that time. They all came and studied under him in his school, and he was the primary spiritual support for Master as William the Conqueror. So again, playing these roles in much the same way. And so in this lifetime, his primary mission was to get Master launched on his mission. And so Master had, it's not like his mission was greater than the others. It was just more of a public expression of it. And so Master, his mission, in one sense, we could think it's to bring these teachings to the West. And that's certainly part of his mission. But because America in particular is the Dwapara Yuga country of the world, we were born, America was born 1776, and you know, however you want to pinpoint, but that's a convenient time to pinpoint it. We were born at the time that Dwapara Yuga started. And so America doesn't have a lot of baggage to carry, a lot of, oh, it's been done this way for 3,000 years, and who are you to tell me that we should change? And so it's flexible, it's new, it's still pliable, like I don't know, fresh leather or something before it's gotten all dried out and gnarly. And so the creativity and flexibility of America was necessary as the place where Master could plant these seeds of Dwapara Yuga thinking and Dwapara Yuga action. And yet those seeds, when somebody asked him, have you come to bring a new religion? He said, no, I've come to bring a new expression. So he wasn't planting seeds that, I don't know, that he did some sort of genetic modification and came up with a new life form. He was planting seeds from the ancient tree of Vedic thought and consciousness that goes way back to Dwapara Yuga and higher ages that were there in a descending yuga. And so he's replanting those. And so this is a new expression. But for us, at this time in the world, it seems like a new teaching. And so it's this old, ancient rootstock that he has planted in the consciousness of the world at this time. And some of the aspects of that are startlingly new, and some of them are ancient as the universe is ancient. One Swami has often talked about is Sanatan Dharma, and that means eternal religion. That's why, have you come with a new religion? No. I've come with a new expression of the eternal religion of Sanatan Dharma. The essence of Sanatan Dharma is that we have all come from God. We are an expression of God. And ultimately, our destiny is to merge back into God. Now that is a, for all of us sitting here, it seems like, well, sure, that seems perfectly logical. But it's not logical in the age in which Master was bringing that to the West. See, the general idea of most Western religion is that we are created by God as something wholly separate from Him. And we can worship Him, or we can fear Him, or we can act in such a way that we can please Him. But if we do all of that and we're good, then we will go to heaven more or less as we are, and we will live eternally. God, what a hell that would be. More or less as we are in heaven. And if we're bad, then really bad things are going to happen to us. And so it's a kind of a punishment, reward, fear, love, all that mixed together. But the point here being is that mankind is separate from God and cannot be one with him. So the teaching of Sanatan Dharma, where we merge back into him, is radical. And that's a relatively radical teaching. There was a book that I read called I Was a Monk by a man who was in the Benedictine order, and he was an American, but he was so versed that he became the primary person to train all the Benedictine priests, and he lived in the Vatican, and he was the primary professor, teacher of that. And at one point he got ill, and in those days he got tuberculosis, and they sent them to Switzerland to sit out on the porch in the cold air, breathe in cold mountain air, in hopes that that would cure their lungs. So he did that for some months. It was basically like being sent to the mountains for seclusion. And during that time, he had a samadhi experience. And so he was faced with this terrible dilemma. Do I go back? I know that I'm part of God. I know that I'm part of everything that exists. I know that there's one whole, one unity. So do I now go back and be the teacher to say that that's not the way things are? I have the experience that says that my former training was not the whole picture. And so he quit and went and became a hermit out toward 29 Palms in Southern California. At any rate, without going into a lot of it, the teaching that Master brought into the West, that we can merge with God, it was a relatively radical teaching. Now, especially in the 1920s when he brought it, now that concept, that mindset has been so thoroughly planted that I don't know what percentage, you know, but there's still older ways of thinking that won't accept that. But there are masses and masses of people, a huge percentage of the population in this country says to a concept that just, you know, when Master came was very radical. They say, well, of course. Why not? Of course. And so, Master, in this age, that's one of the things that his world mission was about, was to have us understand that we could merge with God. The time for knowing God has come, is one of the things that he said. But it wasn't just that teaching. He said he brought the techniques that we can do. So, Kriya is talked about in the autobiography as the most effective technique through self-effort. That's an important phrase in there. But the most effective technique through self-effort ever given to mankind, because it's central to our consciousness. It isn't something outside of us, a ritual, a prayer, or anything outside. It's central to the way that we are built, the way that we're created in this plane of existence. And so to bring the techniques, not just of Kriya, but the other techniques that he brought, of the attitudes and the teachings, when, I don't know if many of you get it, but on the website for Crystal Clarity, you can sign up for This Day in History with Yogananda. Just go there and sign up. So every morning you'll get an email and it will say what Master did on this day in 1927 or 1935. And so you kind of think of, you know, here he is, he's trying to come into a new culture, trying to convince people he would probably have to behave himself. He was a wild man. I mean, he gave classes on how to get rich, how to draw your ideal mate, how to have everlasting youthfulness. 3 days ago, he gave I can't remember what year, he gave a class on how to lose weight through mind control. You know, I mean, this was not meek and mild little Yogananda. He was planting seeds of energy and consciousness into a whole generation and into a whole, let's call it a nation. He was planting the fresh earth of the Dwapara Yuga nation with the seeds of thought that today we say, well, of course, especially a group like this that understands his teachings, we say, well, of course. But there were many things. When he first came to this country, I don't know how many people meditated. Probably nobody. Meditation, really, at that time, was used as a term to sit and be quiet and think about things. That isn't real meditation, not the kind that we know, where you still the mind and control the life force and bring it to the spiritual eye. So he brought the science of meditation, not alone. That's why I say I don't want to act as if it's sectarian and only he was an emissary from God. There were many, but this, we have to realize what we have. Well, we don't have to. We can still stumble around in ignorance if we want to, but it would behoove us to understand what we have in this great line of masters and avatars. These are the people that are here to change the consciousness of the planet. Now, sitting in a little group like this, that sounds a little bit, probably, delusions of grandeur, maybe. But Master sat with Dr. Lewis in a little rented room in the YMCA in Boston and said to Dr. Lewis, "It's going to be big, doctor, big, I tell you." And Dr. Lewis probably thought, a little delusion of grandeur here are you going on, you know? But look at it today, and it's just beginning. It's just beginning. It already is planted in various parts of all over the globe, Master's teachings, this great mission of his. But in not too distant future, it will become kind of the standard, a way of thinking and approaching God, not just on the fringe. It'll be the core. Then it'll be time for us all to move on, because we're pioneers and we have to get ready for Treta Yuga and whatever changes are going to come then. But this is destined. These teachings are destined to spread around the globe and to become the primary core of how we think about the approach to God during Dwapara Yuga, which basically is the next 2,000 years or so. And so for the next 2,000 years, these teachings are going to spread until they're as common in the world as Christianity is today, as Buddhism is today, as science is today. So it's going to plant the mindset. So that's the scope of the mission that Master brought. Now, Ananda's part in that is that, and there are many, many other things that Master planted in the ether and you know, are starting to be trends. But no master that has to live a single lifetime has the chance to do everything that he would like to see happen. And so he needed people to carry on and do the ideas. One of the primary ideas was that the best way to live during Dwapara Yuga is to gather in small communities with like-minded souls that work together, that worship together, that live together, home, job, and church in one place, that understand that fulfillment doesn't come outwardly by having things, so simple living, and that want to live in such a way that they live with uplifted consciousness, simple living and high thinking. And so the whole community's movement, now Master put out that energy very powerfully, especially in the waning years of his life. And Swamiji uniquely picked up on that and dedicated his life to the creation of communities. But the creation of communities is obviously not the only mission of Ananda, but it's certainly one of the core missions of Ananda. Communities as communities is not the central point. The central point is that if you are going to try to dedicate your life to merging with God, it is easier and more effective to do that if you gather magnetically with others who are dedicated to the same thing. So the form of community is much less important than the principle of community, which is essentially a powerful expression of satsang, of group coming together and seeking truth together. And so that powerful expression in a realistic, everyday, live it, experiment with it, try it, let it infuse your jobs, your families, your children, your education, every aspect of life. Take these principles off the shelf, out of the meditation room, and start to live them in daily life. That's what communities mean. And Swamiji vowed that he would do everything in his power to help the spread of these communities and help the spread of Master's work, of his consciousness. And so Master told him to write, to lecture, to edit. And look at what he did. I mean, 150 books. Now you can start to get a portion of his lectures on YouTube. I think they've got 1,000 or 2,000 of up there. And editing, he did that all the time, constantly. So he took the charge that Master gave him and just empowered it like, you know, I don't know, like instead of getting on a bicycle and pedaling to bring these things out, he got in a jet airplane or a jet motorcycle or something. I mean, I'm struggling for an analogy here, but he really did it, is what I'm trying to say, and held nothing back. Well, he has passed on to us that torch, all of us. And so Master passed it on just to a very small handful of disciples. Now, in this time, Swamiji built that. You know, you've probably been in some services where somebody comes with a candle and everybody's holding a candle and somebody lights someone's candle and that person lights the person next to him and then everybody is lighting the ones next to them and it spreads very quickly. One time when I was a kid, I saw a demonstration of they were trying to show what atomic energy was like, where you had energy that started other energy going and other and went faster and faster. So they had this big room and they had probably 2,000 ping pong balls set on mouse traps. And they threw one ping pong ball into that room full of mouse trapped ping pong balls, and that one hit one and it popped a couple more, and in like 2 seconds or 3 seconds, the air of the whole room was filled with ping pong balls. Well, that's Swami. He was, and we're all those little ping pong balls that are in that room. And he has set us off. And by golly, we'd better keep popping. Because if we don't, if we all settle down and get static again, then who's going to be around to kick off other ones. Well, somebody will be, but it won't be us. See, God will do it no matter what, but we won't have the privilege of being those channels. So one of the great things that Swamiji did, one of his great geniuses, was he didn't say, look how special I am. He said, everyone is special. Each one of you is special. And he empowered all of us to be the torchbearers for this new consciousness, this new age that Master and this line of gurus came into the world to bring. And so, as I say, it's destined to cover the entire earth. And we are enormously privileged to be a part of it at such an early stage. Basically, if historically for us, the closest comparison is to say, what would you give in order to be one of the first disciples of Christ? Maybe the first generation of the original disciples. And know that your life meant something to bring that great light into the world and help it spread. And so that's where we are. We're the grandchildren of Master, the children of the first generation of those who lived with him, especially Swamiji in our case. We're the children of all of us, the children of Swamiji. And it is an enormous blessing and an enormous opportunity. And for, we don't want to think this way, but for us, in a selfish way, for our spiritual growth, we're like hanging on to the 2,000 volt wire that's got barely any insulation on it. And if we can hang on to that, a whole lot of energy is going to flow through us, and that is going to change our consciousness. So this is an incredible opportunity of an incarnation. And so let's make the most of it.
Well, it's so wonderful to share these ideas with you. I was just enjoying looking at everyone's faces as Jyotish was speaking, because many of you, some of you had your eyes closed, but many of you were just, your eyes were as open as you could make them. It was beautiful. Continuing with the themes that Jyotish started, there are three points in the autobiography that, for me, define Master's mission. The first is when he was an infant in his mother's arms, and his mother took him to her guru, Lahiri Mahashaya, and you all know the story. She sat quietly in the back, and Lahiri motioned for her to come up, and she made her way through the devotees sitting at Lahiri's feet, and he blessed the child, Mukunda, that she was holding, and he said, your son will be a great engine, a spiritual engine, bringing many souls to God. So the first part of Master's mission was this incredible power to bring people in his wake to God. And then the second pivotal point in my mind was when he was sitting in a little dusty storeroom in his school at Ranchi, and he has a vision and of white faces, and he says, Americans, surely these must be Americans. And then he knew God was calling him to go to the West. A little aside here, I'll share on a personal note. Some years ago, we were performing Swamiji's play, The Jewel and the Lotus, which takes place in India. We were performing it in San Francisco at the Unitarian Church there. And Swami played the storyteller, for those of you who know the play. And I was one of the characters, Kanta, who is an Indian housewife of a wealthy materialistic merchant. And so we were all in our costumes. We had, you know, saris on and dhotis and, you know, Indian regalia and you know, big Indian jewelry and makeup and so forth. And we finished the play, and Swami said, let's go out to dinner. And I said, well, should we change into our, you know, street clothes? No, let's just go. And so we just went out, and we went to an Indian restaurant at the time, Gaylord's. It used to be in Ghirardelli Square in San Francisco. And I think he was doing that to give us an experience, because it was as though I was tapping into a life as an Indian person. And I looked at all the Westerners, and they looked so funny to me. Their skin was so pale, and their hair was all these different colors, and that it lasted the whole evening. It was a very unusual experience, and I think it awakened, maybe it was, Jyotish and I lived part of the year in India, and I think it was to kind of tune me into that life. But in other words, going back to autobiography, Westerners, surely these are Westerners. And then within 2 or 3 days, Master received an invitation to go to America, not speaking any English. And you all know the rest of the story, kind of miraculous, getting a ticket on the first steamship leaving from Calcutta after the war to come to Boston and so forth. And then the third point is subtler, and it's easier to miss in the autobiography. It's the chapter, Babaji's Interest in the West. And I read this recently when we were in India, and it was very clarifying to me. Master said, Babaji was well aware of the complexities and materialistic consciousness of the West and the impact it would have on India. So he had to send an emissary, an avatar, to the West to balance the materialistic complexity of Western civilization, because he knew it would have an impact on India. And any of you who have gone to India in the last 15 years, the impact of the West on India is not that great. I mean, it's powerful, but it's a very mixed bag of materialistic influences. And so Master's mission coming to the West was to awaken spirituality in the West so that it could balance the materialistic influence the West would have on India. And again, it's part of a united evolution of world cultures. And, you know, then within the last year, Prime Minister Modi comes to Washington, meets President Obama, and incredible, echoing Master's words. The two of them, Obama and Modi, write a letter jointly that was printed in the Washington Post, full-page letter, talking about the importance of the coming together of India and America and the shared and complementary values. Well, this was foreseen by the Masters, who knows when, but long, long ago. They could see, as Master said, the material efficiency of the West and the spiritual profundity of the East, bringing those together in Dwapar Yuga. It's the only hope for Dwapar Yuga, with uncounted nuclear weapons proliferating all over the world and natural catastrophes and so forth. Without these two currents coming together, I saw a very interesting statement of an American Indian recently where he said, the eagles and the birds and the trees tell us that man is the endangered species, not the animals, that man is about to destroy himself. And again, this was part of, how many times have those of you who heard Swami Kriyananda lecture talking about the great catastrophe that's coming, and we have to prepare foremost by our own spiritual interiorization of our consciousness so that the yogi can sit unshaken amidst the crash of breaking worlds. So these three points, powerful spiritual engine coming to the West to balance out the materialistic tendencies of the West and bring back that thread of spirituality that's uniting East and West. Recently, a dear friend of ours, who's one of our core members in Gurgaon, India, a very successful businesswoman, from a very prominent family in India. She was educated in the West, but she said only Americans could come to India and take the complexity and subtlety of the science of yoga and have level one, level two, level three, and it works. She said Indians will understand it because they want the Western mentality, but to use the Western mentality to bring yoga, she said, it's brilliant. It's brilliant what you're doing. And that made us feel, oh, we're onto the right thing here. But so uniting these currents, and then Ananda's role in Master's mission, in a way, to my mind, that's it doesn't make sense. Because I have to say, Master Ananda is Master's mission. And I don't see a lot happening outside of it that has real power or meaning. You can argue with me later if you like. But I've traveled around the world and I've seen and I've gone to different centers and I see what Ananda is doing to spread Master's teachings. And there's nothing like it. There's simply nothing like it. The generosity of spirit. You all had satsangs with Sarita and Somnath Ghosh recently, members of Master's birth family, and they were overwhelmed by visiting Ananda, not just one place or another, but collectively. They said, we could not imagine that so much devotion existed in the West, and so much dedication and joy and service and efficiency, everything that they saw. And they said, this is simply amazing. This has changed our life, they said to us. So it's what Ananda is bringing. And what does Ananda mean? It means you and me. It means people that say, these teachings are the core of my self-definition, the practice, the acting on them, the sharing them with others. This is the core of my being. This is what Ananda is. And to have that kind of depth of dedication. We saw that. Where did we get it from? Well, we got it from Swamiji, all of us. From the first day I ever heard him lecture in 1969, it was not shortly after I had seen the movie West Side Story, and there was that song, you know, something's coming, I don't know what it is, but it is gonna be great. And that I just said, that's Swami. I don't know what he's gonna bring, but it's coming, and it's going to be great. And sure enough, he had that power just to ignite all of us. I don't so much like the image of the little ping pong balls, but we can go with that if you like. But with all due respect, but this Ananda's mission, furthering what Master started, we have to really take it seriously, but that isn't the right word. We have to take it heartfully. We have to take it with commitment and joy and the ability to give it everything you've got. And, you know, it's like Yanomata, remember when she was an old woman, body was very ill, and she, whatever Master would want, she would just run up and down the stairs, do whatever errands he asked. And someone, one of the less in tune monastic, said to her, well, don't you ever get tired of just doing exactly what he tells you? I mean, you have your own life. And she just said, you know, you may be right, but I have never been so happy when I've given my life completely in service to my guru. And that's what people don't, you know, they say, well, why don't you ever take a vacation? Why? Why do I need to take a vacation? I'm having lots of fun what I'm doing. And you know, then we start, anyway, we won't go there. But we need to look and see all the aspects of what Swamiji, in tuning in to the comprehensive quality of Master's teachings, what he has brought into play. And we've got a lot going. The educational system that you're doing beautifully here for children. And throughout our Ananda work. And what's the core of education for life? When it's recognizing it's a Dwapara Yuga system of education where you're not training the brain, putting little facts in there, but you're working with the energy of the unique child that is standing in front of you, saying, how do I move the energy of this child to the next step? And that it's Kriya Yoga expressed in education. We have leadership, the same thing. Instead of just saying, okay, here's the hierarchy, you do what I say because I have more power than you. You still wearing that shirt? No, you're not, the t-shirt? He had a wonderful shirt on today that said, oh good, thank you. Power is safest in the hands of a poet. And I just, when I, who said that? Oh, wonderful. When I saw that, I just thought of Swamiji, because he was a poet and he knew how to use power, not to have it over people, but to inspire people and to expand their vision of the potential of life. So leadership by model, by using energy, by having so much energy and commitment yourself that you draw everybody else into that flow of energy. And so many times I saw Swamiji do that. And is that when I was a young girl, woman, I studied a lot of dance. And I had one dance class, maybe I've shared this with some of you before, but it was a very horrible moment in my life where it was a long dance studio and the teacher would demonstrate a pattern that he would improvise every time across the diagonally across the room. And then individually, we had to repeat that pattern all by ourselves, going all across the room. And usually you could get it if you would just be in an intuitive flow, if you didn't try to think about what the pattern was. But one time it was my time to do it, and I just totally did not get the pattern. And I just couldn't do it. And the teacher grabbed me by the hand and he just dragged me right across the diagonal of the dance studio. And I thought, you know, sometimes with Swamiji, it would be like that. We would say, but I don't really think what you're proposing makes any sense and I can't do it and I'm balking. And not with violence, but with joy. He would just say, come along, you'll get it. And he'd just pull us across. And in fact, we did get it in time. Once when Swami was thinking, he changed the name of it, had been Ananda Meditation Retreat. Can I tell you the story on you?
Sure.
Okay. So he changed it to the Expanding Light. And it was like, how can you call meditation retreat the Expanding Light? And he asked Jyotish, well, what do you think? And he said, I don't know, Swami. And Swami said, get used to it. But he would just pull us along in the wake of his inspiration. And so leadership in that way, education, leadership, relationships, friendship, marriage, parenting, to do it in a way that it's just living based on the concept of energy, of freedom, of recognizing the soul in the other person, and not just saying the locked forms, husband, wife, mother, child, friend, whatever it might be, but just saying, we are souls and we are moving on a journey, a track towards God. And Swami modeled, wrote about it, talked about it, modeled it, all these things, health and healing. And we have some marvelous visionary healers sitting. You're very lucky in this community to have this expertise of these people. But it's, again, it's meditation in action. It's learning how to use energy. And all of these things are changing, are giving models for Dwapara Yuga. We don't see it right now because we feel like we're just so insignificant. But as Swami rightly pointed out, the Italian Renaissance in Florence, which changed the course of Western art and culture for centuries and centuries. And in some cases, the masterpieces that were created are unequaled today. You go to see Michelangelo's David and our Pietà, and you just don't think a human being could have created those things. It doesn't seem possible. They're so perfect, absolutely perfect vision of what art could be. But that Italian Renaissance was started by, there were really about 15 or 20 artists and they all knew each other. Some of them hated each other. They were rivals and competitors. But there they were in that one little city. But the creative energy of their synergy changed Western art history. And so I know in my soul, I know many of us came for this purpose, to help Swami further his vision, which he was just an extension of Master's mission. And we came with that. And as Jyotish was saying, let's not miss this opportunity. Let's get it. You know, so often I look back on my life and something very significant had happened and I realized it totally went over my head at the time. And then years later, I get it. We don't have that much time left. Let's look right now at what's important and pick up that torch that Swami's throwing out to all of us, just all of us, whoever will catch it, that torch is there to carry the divine light. And we're so fortunate to have these communities and teaching centers and churches all over the world, and increasingly so. We were giving, and I'll just close with this story, we were giving a lecture in our center in Singapore, and very fine man who's in charge there. And we asked him, he's a successful fiber optic engineer in his late 30s. And he said for maybe early 40s, when he was 16, he was from Chinese heritage, but born in Singapore, third generation Singaporean, really raised without any religion. And he said, when I was 16, I began feeling a call for a spiritual component in my life. And the only thing available to me in Singapore was Buddhism. So I began practicing Buddhist meditation. And I did it for 20 years. And yet, I just felt there's something missing here. There's something missing. And I didn't know where to find it. And then he said, I was passing a church in Singapore, and there was one of the marquees outside with a quote from Jesus saying, ask and you shall receive, Jesus Christ. And he took it literally, and he said, okay, Jesus Christ, you say, I'm going to ask you, and I'm expecting to receive something. Show me your highest teachings. A few days later, someone handed him Swamiji's Essence of the Bhagavad Gita. And he read it, and he said, these are your highest teachings. The highest teachings of Christ, of the great ones, of our age, we've received them. And let's be worthy recipients. Let's say, let's realize the importance of the gift we've been given. I was talking with an old dear friend today who said, I've always avoided speaking in public, but I guess it's mine to do. Yes, it is. It's all of ours to do. And the more we can just move forward like a great tide. Swami was once asked, what is Ananda's mission? He said, to equalize the world on the spiritual plane. For all the chaos and materialistic consciousness, to have a force of light and concentrated spiritual awareness so strong, it's not about numbers, it's about intensity, that it equalizes all of that. It's a nice goal. Take us the rest of our lifetimes to work on it. But that's okay. That's why we came. And it's a joy to share these thoughts with like-minded people like all of you. And we know that your work here in Palo Alto is a light unto the Bay Area, a spiritual haven in a very, very overamped culture here. So keep up the good work. Do the best you can. And we know that Master is using you as his channels to help all those who come. So God bless you.
That's all, folks.